Please remember, the views and opinions expressed by this show or any other show on DV Radio and its guests are strictly those of said individuals and do not reflect those of the DV Radio staff, nor the staff of Dysfunctional Veterans.
Let's go to war, baby!
All I know is war, all I know is shoot. All I want is more. I'm a soldier, I'm a warrior. Got a emblem on my cover. And ask me what I did for ya. I put the trash deep down under. Yeah, I'm a dog of war. Hell's what I've been through. I'm a dog of war. I did it all for you, yeah.
Hey, hey, it's the Sergeant War Dog. Let's go to war, baby. Beginning Wednesday, June 10th, the War Dog Trail podcast will begin being syndicated and broadcast on the DV Radio Network. You can find them on dvradio.net by using the Live 365 app at 7 p.m. when the podcast airs, or on demand using the Podbean app. Sergeant War Dog, salute. And let's go to war, baby.
Okay, we continue. In April 2003, April 6th, 7th, 8th, some around that time period, just after crossing the Diyala River Bridge into Baghdad, we were on the hunt still. And there's day or night, we crept closer to the border. Until we can get to the heart of the city, the heart of the capital. And once we did, we found out there happened to be a Palestine and Sheraton hotel right there in Baghdad that were being used to house the Western, most of the reporters, most of the Western reporters. So we ended up relocating just outside of those hotels, the Palestine and Sheraton hotels. And once we did, you know, we set up our own individual campsites by platoon. And we commenced on duty rotations for protecting the front of the Palestine and Sheraton hotels. Right there in the Ferdows Square, right where Saddam had his massive statue of himself in the center of the city. We are the unit, 3-4, the 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines, that made it to Baghdad and pulled down Saddam's statue in front of the world before CNN to mark the end of Saddam's reign and power and the beginning of U.S. occupation of Baghdad, which obviously is the capital. It was around that time that slowly, you know, bit by bit, the Green Zone was beginning to build up. But it wasn't actually there yet when we had arrived. And remember, when we came that first time, everything about the country was still hot. There were no safe bases. There might have been certain safe areas or safe zones that we'd already cleared. But if you want to think about the way a train moves when it's on the tracks, we were at the front of the train, tip of the spear, headed towards everything dangerous, while everything that remained behind the main push of the train was all considered to be safe, or pretty much safe for the most part, behind us. I remember bits and pieces of things from that period. Specifically, I remember a night where I'd only gotten 45 minutes of sleep for that entire day. Lay down at about 12:15 in the morning, and then around 12:45 I was woken. No, around 1, excuse me. Around 1 a.m., 0100 hours, I was woken right back up and needed to go on duty. And when I was on, I was placed on a fire watch at an entry control position with another Marine, where we stopped any foot traffic from approaching the hotels. And at that time, we did have an older gentleman come up to us who, you know, I didn't know at the time if he might have been senile or maybe suffered from any type of mental health disorders himself. But he walked up to us and he kept scratching and scratching, you know, on his arms, his legs, around his stomach area. And for us, that was an automatic sign that he could possibly be a suicide bomber trying to detonate himself or reach for that igniter. So I do remember that night very well. Luckily, we did end up corralling him and finding out that he was indeed just an older gentleman that was already, you know, senile and had lost some of the better use of his mind. So he'd been wandering around the Capitol that night. So we took him, handed him over to the proper Iraqi authorities who could get him mental help, who could get him medical help, I'll say. And see, continuing on with the first tour, I do remember once being at the Palestine Hotel, walking around with my M249, saw on my chest with a 200-round drum as usual, in case anything happened, because it just was Baghdad, right? Damn it. I mean, but out of nowhere, an army general approached me and was giving me a hard time about why I was still holding my weapon in such a hostile manner. And, you know, didn't I understand the dynamics of the Middle East? And I remember I was 19 at the time. So, of course, I didn't understand everything in terms of geopolitics and cultural awareness the same way he did. With me being, you know, less than a year out of high school. But I knew right then and there that that might have explained a lot of the difference between the way the Marines looked at things and operated, in terms of always being on point or, you know, always trying to maintain that aggressive posture, versus some of the other branches that ended up coming along through Baghdad. You know, once we ended up seeing other individuals from the Air Force or the Navy, or like I said, the Army General that I personally ran into. For now, I'm gonna hold off, take a break, and take you into the Sergeant's Playlist. Shit, wild bitch, I'm in it for mine. You mimic the vibe, you fuck niggas living the blind. I sacrificed a lot just to get to where I'm at. Yo, I ain't spared nothing else. Yo, I sacrificed a lot just to get to where I'm at. Yo, I ain't spared nothing else. Yo. All right, that was C. Reese with his song Sacrifice. C. Reese can be found on Instagram at C_REESE_I_Dangle740. Proceeding on, somehow in this, reminiscing of, our route to Baghdad, I totally forgot about one of the worst days we ever experienced. And that was the day that we were hit by Iraq's worst sandstorm in their entire history. From what I can remember, it was called a Shamal. That was the That's what you call a very bad sandstorm in their language. And I can vividly remember the sky being an orangish brown hue. To the point that it truly made you think you were either in hell or on your way to hell. You could see no sky, no clouds, no sun. Hell, once the wind picked up and the sand began swirling around and going every which way, it got so bad that you couldn't even see your hand in front of you. I mean, if you could imagine that, being in a sandstorm with the sand blowing so bad in front of you that you could stick your hand out in front of your face and not be able to see it because there's so much sand flying in front of you and your face and going every which way, hundreds of miles per hour against you and the entire 1st Marine Division. I mean, it got so bad, visibility got so bad that the entire 1st Marine Division had to halt our forward progress to Baghdad, man. We had to pause the assault on Baghdad because it got that intense. And obviously, in terms of military thinking, we were more worried about the fact that that left us vulnerable to an ambush. With us unmoving like that and having to be buttoned up in our vehicles, doors closed, you know, trying to dodge as much of the sandstorm as possible, trying to breathe. Not to mention, I even saw some guys happen to have masks. Not gas masks, not that type of mask, but you know, the masks that are used, that are even being used now during these COVID-19 times, for breathing. Some guys had those and they broke them out so that they wouldn't continue to inhale all the sand that we were inhaling. And, I'm going to bet that any veterans that later on might have had any respiratory problems after that first tour, a lot of those could be attributed possibly to being involved in that sandstorm. I mean, there's nothing like inhaling sand for hours on end. I don't mean, you know, 1 hour, 30 minutes here. I mean, this thing went on for maybe 8 to 10 hours. So much so that we lost that entire day's worth of movement, stayed in place. We had to sleep there. Then the sandstorm broke into a little bit of rain. So, you know, that turned things, made the situation worse by bringing mud to the picture. And all I can remember specifically is that once that rain hit my gun, hit my 249, the next morning I had to go balls to the wall in terms of scrubbing off any rust that all that water and sand had gotten into my weapon. So any rifleman will tell you, man, the functionality of that weapon is what your life depends on, upon. So, how well it does or does not work or jam or not jam could be the deciding factor in your life and whether or not you live to see another, you know, 10 minutes or another day, all depending on what you're up against. Now, sadly to say, we did end up losing a Marine because of that sandstorm. The force by the winds was so strong that they pushed over a Humvee into a drainage canal, which happened to be, you know, full of water at the bottom. And, once that Humvee turned over, he was that Marine by the name of, Lance Corporal White. He ended up being pinned in, underneath his vehicle so that he couldn't get out and, he ended up drowning. So that sandstorm had its own immense problems and difficulties for all of us. And like I said, to include the taking of a life all because of, you know, natural occurrences in the desert. That was also around the exact same time when, while my buddies and I were standing around on the side of the road, you know, cleaning our weapons and cleaning out as much sand out of things as we could, that we looked up, and sure enough, there was a wild herd of about 30 or 40 camels just hauling ass down the other side of the road, opposite of where we were parked at, and halted on the road. That's probably one of the craziest scenes I've ever seen for all 200 of us to be, you know, doing whatever we were doing, only to look up, look around, and say, see a, you know, herd and stampede of wild camels, man, with no one leading them. Them just hauling ass, bro. Just hauling ass, running down the street. Running down the road for miles and miles, miles on end to wherever the hell they were headed to. Some of the craziest things you see in the desert, man, desert life. But yeah, that is something that has always stood out in my mind. A memory I know I'll never be able to forget. Okay. Now, once, as I said, we did reach Baghdad. We did reach the Palestine and Sheraton hotels. We were there based for maybe a week and a half, to provide security for the reporters, the Western reporters that were there, that happened to be staying in either the Sheraton or Palestine hotels. Let's see, we eventually ran into a day where 20,000 Iraqis came down to the center of the city, to Saddam's statue, after we pulled it down. And all began to shout and scream. And I mean, 20,000 of them, man, shouting at us to go home, bro. They were shouting, go home. It's our home. Go home. It's our home. Man, I can't imagine to you what that's like. B-19 holding M249 in your hands. Worried about snipers. Worried about car bombs. And having 20,000 Iraqis in front of you chanting, go home. This is our home. Not knowing that, hell, you might, given the first opportunity, take a trip right back to the States to enjoy American life, right? But, that's something I can never forget also. Mainly because it involved individuals in the crowd that were mooning us. Yes, sir, they were mooning us. Telling us to go home, showing us their asses, and just completely making things unique and hectic, man. I really don't know what to say or what to call it, but it was a very unique, strange situation there going on in Baghdad. Very, very unique situation. So after enduring the crowds and the insults, we eventually slowly began our way into infantry patrolling again in the city of Baghdad. Most of that we wanted to do on foot, so that we could get a great recon on the city, and you know, figure out what areas we were in and what we were working with and what the city happened to look like. After, like I said, about a week and a half, we left the Palestine Sheraton hotel areas and we moved to a Christian neighborhood. And believe it or not, man, there are actually Christians in Baghdad. So which surprised me, like, you know, beyond words. I remember being there for Easter Sunday of April 2003 and having Iraqis walk up to us and ask if it was okay, if they had permission to be able to go to church that day. And, you know, we looked around at each other like, you know, yeah, you damn right you got freedom to go to church, man. That's why we're here. So you have, you know, freedom of religion. I didn't know that there were Christians in Baghdad. And then for two, I didn't know that, since they were there, they were, you know, persecuted as much as they were. But we remained at we remained in a Christian neighborhood for several days. acting as their police or liaison force for a while, because there was also systemic looting going on throughout the entire country at this time. And I mean, you want to picture, you know, I guess, you know, similar to the looting you'd see here in the States, but on a much smaller level, because obviously we were there with guns and helicopters, and also we weren't going to let things get out of hand as much as we didn't have to. But that was another strange experience for me, to be on a rooftop on security with my M249 and to watch these people down below waving at me as they hauled off TVs, cars, couches, clothes, you name it. If it wasn't nailed down somewhere in a store, they jacked it up and threw it on the back of everything they could, man. I saw carriers with donkeys. I saw men coming up with trucks. I saw guys hot wiring government vehicles and hauling ass with those and still waving thank you at us for letting us take them. Things got kind of funny and crazy in that way. But eventually the Iraqis asked us to step up as their police force, because they had no police, since we were ordered to take out both their police and military personnel. So when they had this looting going on, they had no one really to help them or to have their backs, except for the Marines or the other army personnel that were there in the city. On one particular occasion, we got called to a bank robbery. Imagine that. I'm 19 in Iraq, being called to a bank robbery. So we leave the Christian neighborhood that we're in. We get to this bank, and the gentleman that we're talking to, who's saying he hasn't done anything, somehow has 8 fresh, crisp, brand new $100 bills in his shirt pocket. American now, not Iraqi dinar, but American $100 bills out of this bank. And we walked downstairs to the vault area, because the downstairs held the vault. The upstairs was, you know, your normal customer service areas for a bank. We go down in this bank, and somehow they've gathered enough propane tanks to blow a hole in the safe. Now, what safe can be blown that easily? You know, you can only wonder, being there in Iraq, what, you know, who or how or what that safe was built out of, or what, you know, actual defense it provided. But for me to get there and to have smoke coming up from the downstairs area where the vault was, and to be walking through all this smoke coming from propane tanks, and to know that, even though I grew up in the States and everything that we have and we think about, well, what happens with a bank robbery, I'm at one in Iraq. And these motherfuckers have blown the bank vault with propane tanks. Go figure. And as I said, someone happened to notice in the neighborhood, so they, you know, rushed and asked the Marines to intercede as a police force, man, and we did what we could. We ended up arresting a few of the individuals, zip tying them, returning the money back to the bankers, as we should have, and continuing on policing the rest of the city, policing Baghdad, man. There were incidents that we had to be careful or aware of. There were some Marines who were killed in drive-bys and drive-by shootings. Iraqis would simply, if you're familiar with the way that certain areas in Mexico look, the roundabouts, or you might have a few stop signs that bring you to a central roundabout area, pathway before you can continue on through streets. Many Iraqi streets seem to be made that way, or Baghdad streets, I'll say, seem to be made that way. And, you had no way of knowing who in a car, you know, liked you, didn't like you, was armed, wasn't armed. So there were reports of Marines that were being killed by drive-bys and drive-by shootings. Iraqis just, you know, blatantly hiding in with the civilian populace and taking shots. That's something that we had to be aware of and cognizant of at all times, 24/7. Right now, we're going to take yet another break. We'll jump back into the Sergeant's playlist again. This time, we're going to rock with Big Bill 407 and his song, Ice Cream Man.
Watch me like cable. Ain't asking for no favor, just trying to get some paper. Stack it up high, know the white will motivate you.
Let's go to war!
Alright. That was Big Bill with his song Ice Cream Man. You can find Big Bill on Instagram at big_bill407. Again, you can find Big Bill on Instagram at big_bill407. Once, while we were in Baghdad, living in that Christian neighborhood, we had a local corner store that my platoon and I would hit up quite often. And that was probably where I developed my love for sardines, right then and there. This little Iraqi store happened to have a little Fanta sodas and plenty of sardines dipped in hop sauce, man, in these cans. And after weeks of MREs, well, and, you know, months since I had an American meal, I fell in love with those sardines in Baghdad. That's no lie. I straight up fell in love with sardines to this day based on my need to survive in Baghdad on something other than MREs. That's real. That's just the way that worked out, man. I do remember another night patrolling through Baghdad, and we happened to get eyes on a guy in an apartment complex before he saw us. But once he did see us, he cocked his AK back in the middle of the night, and I just knew that he was about to open up on us. I mean, I knew without a shadow of a doubt. What else would he do after, you know, racking around into the chamber of an AK and aiming at us? Would he do besides fire and open up on the entire squad of 13 to 15 Marines? Once he did that, we all laid in prone, took cover, you know, embraced as best as we could for what we thought was coming, for the enemy that we thought he was. But we happened to have an Iraqi interpreter with us, so he shouted who he was in the middle of the night. I'm sorry, the interpreter shouted who we were to the guy with the AK, and the guy responded that, you know, he wasn't looking to harm us in any way. He was protecting his home and his business from looters. So, pretty good thing that we had an interpreter on hand to, de-escalate that situation, to let him know who we were so that he could respond appropriately. And that, you know, we were able to then get up off the ground and continue moving forward with our patrol without having to, take his ass out. You know what I mean? That's all I can grasp right now about Baghdad, or being there in the city, in the heart of the city. After being there for at least a good maybe 2 weeks, we as 3-4, 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines, we pushed out to a remote area in the desert. For some reason, maybe to regroup or to re-strengthen, but we pushed out to an entirely desert area with our tanks and AAVs. And it was there that we held our first funeral memorial services. With 3-4, we happened to lose a total of 10 Marines. No, excuse me, a total of 6 Marines. So at that desert location on the outskirts of Baghdad, we gathered for the first time as a battalion since Kuwait. And we held our own for funerals and our, you know, memorial service right there in the open. Well, all 1,200 of us had the opportunity to walk in front of each Marine's boots, weapon, and Kevlar helmet to pay our respects to the 6 of them that made the ultimate sacrifice during that fight and that scrap to get from the Kuwait border all the way into Baghdad. This is also around the time that many guys started to get the runs, man. Many guys started to come down with what we later found out was a small strain of malaria. Even though we had been taking anti-malaria pills and whatnot, you still had to be careful with the populace or with the mosquitoes that were out there that could easily transported. So it was pretty bad in terms of living conditions. After that first spot on the outskirts of the city, we again relocated to another facility that I believe happened to be a former army Iraqi army headquarters also. Yeah. And it was big enough to hold our entire battalion of 1,200 or so Marines. But there was where we departed from having our Amtraks and our tank escort. Because we were the unit that pulled Saddam's statue down, we were awarded the Presidential Unit Citation, the PUC. And I guess as a part of that reward, we were also allowed to be one of the first units to go back home, since we had gone the farthest and been through some of the most intense combat amongst infantry units. That coupled with the fact that, you know, to top it all off, once we made it there, we were the same unit that pulled down Saddam's statue in front of the world to signify that he was no longer in power or in control of his own country, that we were, in essence. That martial law was in effect, and that the Marines were there handling shit. Now, that next campsite that we moved to was where we remained until we left the country to head back to Kuwait. And once we did get there, it was so bad, like I said, with the so many guys having the runs, man, having the bubble guts, that we nicknamed that camp Camp Shithole. And that happens to be the location where I first picked up smoking cigarettes, actually, man. I mean, so many things that happened, so many things we've been through, that one day while we were there, I just asked a buddy of mine to let me have one of his cigarettes. And once he did, and I saw how well that helped me cope with things and, you know, the kind of socializing allowed me to do with the other smokers and whatnot, it really did a lot for me. I'm not proud that I smoke cigarettes under any circumstances, but if that was the coping mechanism that I needed or that it helped me to get through, then by all means, I'd rather choose that than, you know, any of the many hundreds of other things, other worse substances that I could have come into contact with or began using. But we stayed at the Camp Shithole location for at least 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Each day, we could see other units either heading into Iraq or heading out of Iraq to head back to Kuwait. but never was it for us. And the way you knew that the ride was for you was just a convoy full of, you know, large charter buses, man. You see a convoy full of large charter buses, man, that means that was your day home. That was your bird ride home. Means they were coming there to pick you guys up, give you your ride back. So eventually, around mid to the end of May, we did get picked up. We were taken back to Camp Matilda, Kuwait, which was still there. That camp was still around, even though our original camp, Camp Ripper, was so close to the Iraqi border that we had to tear that down and burn everything down that we were using and living in after we left to engage for the assault on the border, assault on Baghdad. But we got back to Kuwait, back to Camp Matilda. Got a chance to finally get acclimatized, to get a, you know, hot showers, hot food. Some guys were able to make phone calls, you know, that sort of thing. Call back home. And then we began the transition to head back to the States once we found out what our flight date was, our flight times. You know, we began to pack things up the way they needed to be packed for the ships, for any of the large equipment we had that was going to need to be transported back to the States. At that time, from what I remember, we weren't doing much unit to unit handovers of equipment or weapons or anything. We were all kind of keeping our own equipment attached to each unit individually as its own. And then each unit that would come into the country would come in and bring their own stuff that they already had. So eventually our flight dates came along. We went through customs inspections to make sure we weren't taking back, AKs or any weapons or any unallowed types of souvenirs, because everyone had a souvenir of some sort. It's just, you know, the nature of warfare. But anything that might have went above and beyond what was legal or what was allowed or what was deemed appropriate was removed by the customs MPs. And it even affected some people, some Marines. I'd also heard or found out had tried to sneak things onto the planes to get back home. And the problem was by doing that, or maybe with the frequency with which others were trying to do it, there became a large penalty to where if one person in your unit was caught doing it, they might delay or block or slow down the flight date and return home for the entire unit. Or at least that's what we were told at the time. So they instilled a lot of, fear or anxiety in us to not steal or bring back anything that we weren't supposed to, or to hide it in any kind of hidden compartments that we weren't supposed to, because we weren't going to go through such a thorough customs inspection. But, like I said, eventually our flight date did come along. We went through customs. I happened to be assigned to the working party that had to load the belly of the Delta airliner that picked us up from Kuwaiti International Airport. I was on the working party that loaded the belly of that plane with Marine backpacks and sea bags. Somehow I got stuck with that job 3 years in a row, which, you know, you could look at it in many different ways. Say, hey, at least you were alive and you were able to be one of the ones doing that. But I found it all to be pretty tiresome, man, to be loading, because, you know, that's two bags per man, so you have 200 guys. You're loading, 400 to 500 bags worth of their equipment and sea bags and backpacks into this plane While normally, you know, I don't know how it's done at the airport, but you usually don't, usually you have conveyor belts and all other types of assistance to help you get that job done. While we had no choice but to go at it raw and do what we could, the best we could, to get the job done. I remember leaving Iraq the first time around March 23rd. Excuse me, around May 23rd of 2003. And I really, really was excited to want to get back home as a war veteran. You know, the same way we've all seen in war movies or historical movies we've all seen. I didn't know if there was going to be ticker tape parade or approval or disapproval like there was in Vietnam, people hating us, spitting at us. I had no idea. So I was really curious as a 19-year-old as to what it was going to be like to head back home for the first time post-war and to return as a decorated combat veteran, finally. A decorated Marine infantry rifleman with a tour in Iraq to include the very first day of the war. On our route back to the States, remember I told you coming in, we went from, we flew from our base in California to New York, then New York to Germany, Germany to Kuwait, and then we drove across the border with the rest of the 1st Marine Division. Now, on the flight back home, it was similar. We went from Kuwait to Germany, from Germany to, I want to say, D.C., to Dulles Air Force Base, and then from D.C. back home to Southern California. And it was crazy to be able to make it back home that first time. Because as soon as we touched down, word was been passed around on the local newspaper that, you know, hey, some of the Marines who pulled the statues down were back and that they were coming back home. And the love that we got, man, as we rode our buses back home and we rode on American highways again and we heard American music and had American food again. The love that we got from leaving the Air Force base that we arrived at in Southern Cali all the way back to our ride to our base back in 29 Palms, California. We got nothing but love from all Americans everywhere. I mean, people would come out from, you know, their jobs or restaurants and they were lined up around the streets just waving us in, and the radio stations were broadcasting our location so people knew in each city when to come out and to wave us home or wave us in and that sort of thing. It was a really neat experience. Once we did reach our base, it was even more of a magical experience because we had the Marine Corps band there waiting for us and playing. And that's a rare occurrence in and of itself to just have them playing in the middle of the street for you, especially at 7 or 8 o'clock at night. But I remember, you know, once we reached the base, our first steps were to return to the armory, drop off our guns, our night vision, everything that we would keep locked up in the armory, our bayonets, all of that stuff. And we had a few talks, a few formations, a few safety briefs about what to do and not to do. And then we were released, man, to go enjoy being home in the States again. And me at 19, I had a buddy in my, platoon who was from San Diego. So I chose to spend my first weekend back in the States in the beautiful city of San Diego. All right. Let's go back to the Sergeant's playlist just one final time here. I'm going to bring you Caleb Daniels once again. And this is his song, Like Whoa.
Hey, riding in the whip through the night hitting curves. I just hit the gas, I don't put it in reverse, yeah. I can do this every week. If you hit me for the feet, it's 100 for the verse. 50 for the hood, bitch, that's work. How do I look, baby? Tell me what you heard. And you heard the new shit, and you hit me right back, saying that you want it back. Funny how the shit work. I just put in work, cut to the chase. I ain't worried about y'all, I'ma make what I'm making. If you don't fuck with it, give a fuck what you think. All my boys don't give a fuck what you say. Baby, what's your name? That's the only thing I need. You can put it in my phone with your number underneath. And when you walk by, you just caught me by surprise, so I had to look back, and I'm loving what I see. Baby, hit my snap, make a clap for the kid. We can let it ride in the back for the kid. I get a deep end, I'm a splash in the shit. Everything I do, I'm doing it with passion and shit. And there ain't a lot of rappers that can rap with a kid. That's no cap, that's true shit. And I'm going in like a motherfucking Q-tip. Big ass with a waist looking like a toothpick. I just got bad like, whoa, ay. If you wanna ride, let's go, ay. I've been going hard for show, yeah. I've been going hard for show. I'ma do all the things that I won't do. I'ma go everywhere that I won't go, ay. But I just got bad like, whoa, ay. I just got bad like, whoa. Bitch, I'm the everywhere kid. Forecast for the day looking real sunny, but we raining new music on their heads, keep them running. Hey, hey, and you can laugh now, but it's something real coming. I'll be laughing at the bank like it's something real funny. Hey.
All right, that was Caleb Daniels with his song Like Whoa. You can find Caleb on Instagram at I Am Caleb Daniels or on Twitter at I Am Caleb Daniels. Okay, that will conclude this episode. This has been Sergeant War Dog in the War Dog Trail. This was episode 18. I hope you enjoyed. Salute.
All I know is war. All I know is shoot. All I want is more, but I got some things to do. I'm a dog of war, hell's what I've been through. I'm a dog of war, I did it all for you.
DVD Radio.